Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Brothers and sisters, welcome to today's edition of The Big Picture here live on Radio Islam International. I'm your host for today, Mustafa Darsad, surname for Brother A.B. Dalji. And also a special welcome to our Radio Al Ansar listeners, which we're getting a live feed from Radio Islam. Anyway, what do we have to discuss today? Well, there's a few things that are... Well, we're going to talk about the Solidarity March, which is going to take place on next Sunday, the 16th of February, here on the Durban Beach Promenade. We'll talk about Trump's, what has been happening with Trump's recent victory, and whatever other topics we can touch on. Now, just to put you guys in the picture, that there's a Solidarity March, which is going to take place on next Sunday, the 16th of February 2020, on the beach, Durban Beach Promenade. It is an awareness against the religious discriminatory CA law in India. And the whole idea is to foster unity here in South Africa. And all are invited. It's from people from all religion backgrounds. And because we need to show our unification, that we are united in diversity in our country here in South Africa, especially given that we've come from an apartheid background. To discuss more with me, I'm getting two guests on the line. I'm getting Brother Aslam Mayat, and who is no stranger to the listeners, as he covers some of the shows as well. And then we have Dr. Faisal Suleiman, who is the chairman of SAMNET. We're just trying to wait for our producers to get them on air. Nevertheless, just to give you, while we're waiting for them, just to talk about a few updates, one of which is on everybody's mind, which is the coronavirus. 2 weeks ago, I spoke about the coronavirus, the latest strain being the novel coronavirus, which the WHO has termed the 2019 nCoV, N for novel, COF coronavirus. Sorry, COV for coronavirus. At that time, there were a few deaths and a few cases. Now, within 2 weeks, within China itself, there's been 700 or close to 750 deaths reported, between 725 to 750 deaths as of this morning, and 35,000 reported cases. The alert has been spread throughout the country. When I spoke to you 2 weeks ago, it was only around the province surrounding the city of Wuhan, which was with the neighboring 18 cities, which covered 56 million people, the population of South Africa. But now the whole country is on high alert. There's been a lot of international flights that have been cancelled, etc. All theme parks have been closed for various reasons, and they say that the way the virus is heading, it's going to be more deadly than the SARS virus, which struck China back in 2003, and also the Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS virus, which struck the Middle East in 2012. And all these strains of viruses, emerge from animals. This being the of this novel coronavirus, which stemmed from bats and snakes, and also the pangolin, which is a sought-after exotic delicacy dish in China. Now, it's been just saddened that the whistleblower for the coronavirus was a Dr. Li Wei Liang, who was 34 years old and ophthalmologist. And he was the one that sounded the alarm bells in December about this, what he calls a SARS-like virus. He put it, he shared it with friends and colleagues on WeChat and said that, this is very worrisome and, something needs to be done about it. And straight away, the authorities arrested him because he was alleged to have spread rumors, and he was reprimanded for the false alarm. And he was taken into custody, and recently the toll of the virus took the virus took its toll on him, and he was hospitalized. And 2 days ago, on the 6th of February, this past Thursday, he passed away, and he's now been celebrated as a hero. For had the authorities taken him seriously, maybe there would have been better precautionary measures. There would have been, instead of being reactive like what we've seen in the middle of January or the latter part of January, they would have been more proactive in combating this this outbreak. So far in South Africa, 42 cases have been reported to the, you know, or shall I say 42 cases of scare have been reported regarding the coronavirus. And today on the radio I've heard that the, on SAFM, that all 42 cases have turned out to be negative. Shukr alhamdulillah. Now, coming back to the Solidarity March, I have with me, just to make an announcement, my friend and colleague, Brother Nazir Malik, who will announce the Solidarity March and the details. Brother Nazir, over to you. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum to you and the listeners of Radio Islam. How are you, Mustafa Darsot?
Alhamdulillah, and Nazir, and how are you?
Alhamdulillah, all excited about this march to take place and make the history in Durban. It is imperative that we as Muslims, and not only Muslims, but whoever, even if you're a non-Muslim, to support this march and make our numbers on that day, because every media will be covering that march. It be it the newsprint, be it the TV, and all medias will and radio stations will be there covering this march. The most important thing, Mustafa, about this march is that I think we need to raise awareness. Awareness about the CAA rule. This Citizen Amendment Act, how it would affect the people of India, not just the Muslims. It is a humanitarian issue that we are dealing with. It is a humanitarian issue that we are desisting, and we are saying, you know what, this shouldn't happen anywhere in the world. Now that the law CAA is in contest, the whole of India is in up in arms, and I think we around the world, you know, the hadith of Nabi alayhi salatu wasalam is very clear to the effect that if something evil is being done, you need to stop it with your hand. If you can't stop it with your hand, then stop it with words. If you can't stop it with words, then at least feel it in your heart. And that's what we need to do. We need to show our solidarity.
100% correct. For Brother Nazir, can you just give the details on the exact time and the route, etc.?
Okay, the date is the 16th of February. I repeat, the 16th of February, which is next Sunday. The time for congregating will be 8:45 a.m. And the place to congregate will be the amphitheater in the Marine Parade. The amphitheater is right opposite the Elangeni Hotel. We will all congregate there. The concerns that you may have is adequate security provided, ample security, ample marshals, and it is a coordinated march by all the various Islamic organizations in this country, and they will all be participating there. It is open for one and all, be it Muslims or non-Muslims. It is not a religious issue, it is a humanitarian issue. So we start at 8:45 congregating. The march will start at 9 a.m. A few words by prominent speakers about the rules of engaging in this march, and of course what this march is all about, will then be addressed at the amphitheater. We walk towards the paddle pool and return back to the amphitheater. Even, I know your concerns that it may be hot, but the total distance return is maximum 1.3 kilometers. It's not very far, so we do have provisions for water and whatever hydration means that we will be providing. Your attendance is very important, and that's what we are appealing to everybody. Listeners of Radio Al-Islam, please, Radio Islam and Al-Ansar, it is imperative that we show our solidarity and support for this march, because the greater our numbers, we don't want to be there with small numbers and then the Modi government thinks that, you know what, it's fine for him because, look, the Muslims are not even supporting issues of this nature. So I appeal to everyone, every one of you listeners, to partake in this march and show your support as a nation. And you know what, what's very important, there's a group from India that is now operating in South Africa, and a group of people have joined them here in South Africa, bringing the very same ideology into South Africa and dividing the Indians. We in South Africa live harmoniously. with our neighbors, be it Hindus, be it Tamilians, whoever we may be, but we live in harmony, and these people are trying to divide us here in South Africa. So we're saying, no, this will not happen here in South Africa. So come in your numbers, come with your family. The one greatest reason that we chose a Sunday is because everybody is available. So I appeal to you once again, on behalf of all those organizations, please come in your numbers and show your support, please. Jazakallah khair.
Jazakallah, Brother Nazir, and inshallah we'll update also the listeners next week as well, the day before the march.
Jazakallah, Mustafa. Thank you so much.
Okay, Assalamu alaikum. Alright, now we have with us on the line another one of the other organizers, Brother Aslam Mayat, who will discuss more about the event. Brother Aslam, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Assalamu alaikum to all.
Hello, Brother Aslam, do you have me on the line?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me? Hello?
Sorry, listeners, I'll just wait for Brother Aslam to come on air, then we'll continue. Just to make a short announcement is that Brother A.B. Dawji said, I must please inform the listeners that his dad, Uncle Ahmed Dawji, again went to hospital this week and was into ICU yesterday and today. Alhamdulillah, he is making progress, but please remember him in your duas. He is 89 years old. Please remember him in your duas, and that Allah Ta'ala grant him shifa kamila, inshallah, ameen. Just to check if we have Brother Aslam on the line. Okay, we'll wait just to see what's happening with our engineers. Okay, just to move on to what's been happening in the United States, or should I say the land of the free. Well, Trump, as you know, this week was emerged victorious from his impeachment hearings. And the thing is that should we be surprised about it? Really, I mean, whoever was hoping that he would be impeached, well, I mean, the thing is, everybody was hoping that he'd be impeached. But really speaking, have we thought about it carefully, that what would have happened had he been impeached and who would have taken his place? But just to give you some background as to some of the reactions that we've got there, for example, the Republicans came out strongly and they all closed ranks. And, you know, they were also quoted in various media after Trump's victory that, yeah, he was a bad ruler. He did a lot of wrong things, you know, but that all aside, at the end of the day, he's our president and we stand by him. And that sounds very, very familiar. We've had it here in South Africa when Zuma was president for 10 years. I mean, every time the matter was taken up, whether it was in parliament, whether it was an ANC-NEC meeting, we saw the ANC closing ranks and, you know, standing behind him. So, really speaking, should we be surprised that he emerged victorious from this impeachment hearing? And the thing is that you know, on the more of the amusing side, but this was a big insult to Trump when he gave the State of the Union address, which happens annually in the United States, generally in January, but this time it took place on Tuesday, the 4th of February, where we saw the Congress House Leader Nancy Pelosi, who was from the Democratic Party, tear up Donald Trump's speech just as he completed his address. And this is in full view of all cameras. It's gone widely on social media. There's been a lot of pictures and cartoons made about it. And when she was asked, why did you do such a thing? She said, well, because it was the courteous thing to do. So, you know, the thing is that Trump is the most disliked person at the moment in the United States, although he is the president. And you know, we have to understand that, you know, our emotions aside, yes, we know, especially when it comes to, you know, the laws that he's trying to put in place, for example, the anti-Muslim laws, all his rhetoric, etc., banning Muslim travel, banning Muslims from traveling to the States, etc. But really speaking, who would have replaced him had he been impeached? Because had he been impeached, he would have been obviously removed from his post. And given that he has a deputy in place, which is his vice president, Mike Pence, also known as Mickey Pence, he would have taken his place. And would we have wanted a president like Mickey Pence to be at the helm at this moment in time? No. The reason being because Mickey Pence, if you thought that Trump was bad, Mickey Pence would have been far more worse. And who is this man? Well, known as Michael Richard Pence, a lawyer that hails from the state of Indiana and served as the 50th governor of the state of Indiana, is an evangelical Christian. Right? Now, just to put you in the picture, the southern states of the United States, from Texas in the, you know, in the Midwest to the west of the country, right up to the East Coast, you're talking all those southern states are known as the Bible Belt. And part of, and some of those states creep up into the Midwest states of part of Illinois, Indiana, etc. And this is where Mickey Pence comes from. He is one of those hardline, redneck, right-wing evangelical Christians. And you have also the other extreme, the Southern Baptists, right? You have the Protestants that are all there. And these denominations have come about after, when the British ruled, when the British colonized America, the southern states were dominated by the British rate of Anglican Christians, and then after that, the southern states, you know, basically broke out into these various branches. Now, you will find that the Latino population in the United States, they are Roman Catholic, and one thing is that these right-wing Christians do not see eye to eye with the Roman Catholic, because the Roman Catholic generally are the more peaceful, in the approach towards their fellow mankind. Now, what has happened with that is that in the southern states, you have, as I said, these redneck, you know, racist, right-wing, not all of them are racist, mind you, but you have these sort of people who are there, and they tend to feel that they are superior. They hold very strongly to their Christian values. They feel that, you know, when it comes to, that you cannot offend God, you know, they are very, they're anti-abortion, they're anti-LGBT, they stand for the death penalty, things that will befit a so-called perfect society. But at the same time, they look down upon those who are not of their color and not of their creed and religion. And that's who Mickey Pence is. And if you thought that, you know, there's no such thing that you cannot get anybody worse than Trump. Remember something, when George W. Bush was the President of the United States, when he was the President of the United States between 2000 and 2008, you thought that you could not get a worse leader or a worse president than George W. Bush. Well, you had Donald Trump that came into office, right? One would have thought being a wealthy corporate businessman who ran his own show, The Apprentice, you know, having some sort of education, if I put it to you in inverted commas, would be, you know, despite all his rhetoric, etc., would be, you know, better leader. But at the end of the day, you saw in the run-up to his presidency, his true colors started coming out. And obviously, the moment he took office, I mean, it was all there. It was all there in open. And then you will have this right wing coming in, and he will be worse. I mean, he may be more diplomatic, he may be more, approachable in certain ways, whereas Trump is very, you know, to himself and it's his way or the highway. But at the end of the day, this would have been the situation had he been impeached, had he been removed from office. Anyway, coming to a more to the other side, in the also in the United States, we have Bernie Sanders. And he is now currently leading the Democratic race. He's even recently taken over former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, who served under Barack Obama. And what has been interesting is that we've seen a shift. For the very first time, you've seen the shift within the U.S. echelons of government, which you never saw before. And what you what's been happening is that you are seeing more and more, you know, lawmakers in the Congress and hopefully amongst the Senate that will come on board and will speak out, in a sense of, even if it means in a mild way, but they are speaking out, and this is symbolic. Now, I have in my hands here a letter written by the Congress of the United States, right, signed by 105 congressmen and women from the Democrats, right, addressed to the President, dated 2 days ago, the 6th of February 2020. And I'll just read parts of it to say that, dear Mr. President, we write to express our strong disapproval of your administration's proposal, the purported aim of which is to advance peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Our concern is both with the substance of your plan, which will exacerbate and entrench conflict rather than resolve it, and with the timing of its release. Right? He says, in December, the U.S. House of Representatives passed Resolution 326 with bipartisan support. The resolution indicated congressional opposition to unilateral annexation of the West Bank, asserted long-standing U.S. opposition to settlement expansion, and reaffirmed that any viable U.S. proposed peace plan must include support for a two-state solution. The real two-state solution is the only conflict-ending means of securing both national self-determination for Palestinians and an Israel that is secure, democratic, and a homeland for the Jewish people. However, the ultimate deal, in inverted commas, that your team has incubated for the past 3 years is not a serious and or good faith attempt to bring such a durable peace between the parties of this conflict. Of utmost concern, your proposal effectively paves the way for permanent occupation of the West Bank. It endorses unilateral annexation of Israeli settlements as well as the Jordan Valley. While your proposal uses the language of statehood for Palestinians, it provides for far less than an actual viable state, a collection of disconnected Palestinian enclaves surrounded by actual viable state. Settlements and a settlement infrastructure annexed by Israel and still under Israeli control does not constitute statehood. Crafted by a team that has long indicated its animosity to actual Palestinian statehood, your proposal attempts to make a genuine two-state solution impossible. Right? And it goes on. And it's signed by 105 congressmen and women, something which we have never seen before. Even the bipartisan resolution that was taken place in December. Now, you've seen these sudden shifts, although symbolic, yes, in its infancy, but it's a start. Because if you look back, that the power of the Israeli lobby in the United States is the most fiercest, the most effective, and the strongest in the world. Right, and you've seen this coming about. And generally, what happens is when you see any criticism of Israel, whether it's a politician, whether it's a journalist, etc., that's high profile in the United States, you'll find that immediately a smear campaign is initiated against that person, backed by generally by AIPAC and others, and that person suddenly is gone. Gone quiet. One of them was former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, who was 10 years ago aboard the Mavi Marmara, which the Israelis intercepted in international waters when it was heading on its way from Istanbul to Gaza. And because the very fact that she was on the flotilla, when she returned back to the United States, straight away there was a disinformation campaign against her. There was, strong attempts to discredit her, and even when in the election just soon after that, she was her rival candidate was widely supported and funded, and she lost the race. So this is what the type of things you've seen, and this is encouraging. And given that Bernie Sanders, who is a Jewish person, to hold such strong views on Palestine and to think with an open mind, discredits and dispels the Zionist narrative that all Jews support the state of Israel unconditionally, and it should be, sorry, let me rephrase that, all Jews should support the state of Israel unconditionally. No. The thing is that people do have a conscience, like how we've seen what's happening in India with the Citizenship Amendment Act, right? We are aware by Hindus and Christians and Sikhs, etc., all coming out in the streets in their numbers, showing support with the Muslims, that at the end of the day, this law is discriminatory, although it excludes only Muslims, but it is discriminatory. And if this goes ahead, then it obviously opens the door for many other discriminatory laws to come in. And that's why the people are taking the stand that you've seen right now. Moving on to something else. Recently, there has been an announcement made by Israel and Sudan that they're going to normalize relations. And this is, of course, of big concern, because at the end of the day, Sudan has been one of those that have been always against the state of Israel or never recognized the state of Israel. So in order to understand this in context, I just put together something from an article, from a couple articles, and it said that this meeting that took place between Netanyahu and Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who is the head of Sudan's Sovereign Council in Entebbe, Uganda, and the subsequent announcement that the two countries will normalize relations has indeed come as a shock. Traditionally, Sudan has been among the Arab nations most hostile to Israel, and the Sudanese public, by and large, retained this feeling. Last year, the country was swept up by a revolution pushing for dignity, justice, equality, and democracy, principles that contradict Israel's oppressive colonial presence in the region and its policy of colluding with dictatorial regimes. To understand the context of the meeting, it is important to recall that Sudan was listed by the United States as a state sponsor of terrorism back in 1993 over claims of providing material support to Al-Qaeda. This designation, with all international sanctions associated with it, presents a major obstacle to Sudan in accessing foreign aid and dealing with its massive national debt. Right. The United States maintains that Sudan was complicit in the 1998 terrorist attacks on its embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, which killed 224 people. At the time, Al-Qaeda's leader Osama bin Laden, who ordered the attacks, was known to reside on Sudanese territory. The U.S. insists that Sudan must pay approximately $10 billion in damages, $5.9 billion of which to the families of the American victims before the sanctions are lifted. In justifying its position, Washington hides behind the independence of the judiciary and claims that it is a purely legal process that has nothing to do with politics. However, it is ethically questionable to have the Sudanese people, who had no idea what was transpiring in the most remote part of their country with terrorist training camps during the late 1990s, be held hostage to the past abuses of a dictatorship which they did not elect. And if you recall last year on the show, I spoke to Brother A.B. Dowji covering what happened in Sudan, especially after the fall of Omar al-Bashir, and as well as when the new transition government came into being. Right? Now, it must be clear that the revolution they launched, which toppled the regime of Omar al-Bashir and led to a political transition, will not succeed unless the economic situation on the ground is addressed, and this designation is one of the main obstacles to economic recovery. And we are seeing that this is the reason why there's another Arab Spring emerging. We've seen it in Lebanon, we've seen it in Iraq, etc. And the thing is that it's economics at the end of the day. People are fed up of the rising cost of living, of which is obviously due to corruption and fraud that is taking place in their governments. Right. Now, at this recent meeting which took place in Entebbe, Uganda, Netanyahu appears to have promised, now this is where it comes, Netanyahu has appeared to have promised General al-Burhan, who took over from al-Bashir, that he could convince Donald Trump to delist Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. Can we trust Netanyahu? Clearly, Netanyahu's claims is disingenuous and misleading. His track record suggests that his more likely aim is to repatriate some 4,500 to 5,000 Sudanese refugees who are currently in Israel. Furthermore, Sudan's leaders would do well to remember that while there is a perception in some Arab diplomatic capitals that the most effective route to changing U.S. policy is through normalization with Israel, few Arab states have benefited materially or otherwise from attempting to do so. Most critically, attempts to normalize ties run the risk of the transitional administration losing the support of the Sudanese street, which is already on the line due to the country's persistent economic crisis. This does not mean that there are no other ways out of this difficult situation. Sudan can take a number of steps which do not go against the will of its people and hurt the Palestinian cause in order to get out of the crisis. Sudan can seek assistance from the international community to lift sanctions and drop the designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. It can do that by handing over al-Bashir for prosecution to the ICC for crimes he has been accused of committing in Darfur. Sudan should also be prepared to defend itself in the U.S. court against accusations of sponsoring terrorism. There is no room for pride in such matters, and cooperating with international courts would build goodwill internationally and could presage a return to the global diplomatic fold. Within this context, Sudan should also request international assistance in repatriating funds that have been stolen by al-Bashir and his cronies and stashed away in foreign bank accounts. Swift action on this front could help immensely the cash-strapped Sudanese transitional government. Sudan should also seek international assistance to address its major economic crisis. By some estimates, Sudan's national debt sits at $57 to $60 billion, of which was accrued due to unmet interest payments. The Sudanese leadership would seek to engage in discussions on debt relief or forgiveness with the Gulf states and countries like France, which hold a considerable amount of its debt. Entering into such negotiations in good faith while being publicly seen to stand up to corruption would boost investor confidence and give some hope to local businesses. With the price of bread being a major trigger issue for the original protests that toppled al-Bashir's regime, an austerity drive to cut subsidies to bread, fuel and other essentials would be an act of political suicide by Sudan's fledgling transitional administration. Although aid from foreign patrons such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE in exchange for loyalty may be tempting, the Sudanese leadership should stay away from making such political commitments, given the explicit interest those countries have in shoring up the military at the expense of the revolutionary. And a case in example to cite is what happened in Egypt. Sudan needs to remain committed to embarking on a national transitional process alongside concomitant subnational peace process. While much international attention has been placed on upheaval in Darfur, the Blue Nile and South Kordofan regions, the conflict in eastern Sudan threatens to escalate in the coming months. There is fear that the situation would become another Darfur, right? This would be tragic in terms of loss of life and the negative effect on social cohesion, but will also complicate Sudan's already complex intertwined conflict dynamics and refocus international headlines on resolving yet another conflict at a time when the conversation should be focused on the economic crisis and the transition to civilian-led rule. This is the challenge that Sudan is facing, and basically, you know, the Israel factor has to be the deal sweetener. Should it not? At the end of the day, Sudan has to take charge of its own affairs and move forward, and yes, it has to be proactive, like for example, handing over al-Bashir to the ICC, meeting with the countries that are holding its debt and ask for debt forgiveness and debt relief, and, you know, look for better economic policies in order to be inviting to foreign investment and to boost up local business. And we're not seeing, it doesn't stop with Sudan. As I said, now we've seen recently what's been happening for the past few months in Lebanon and Iraq. And obviously this is a ripple effect, or a domino effect, should we say, that is going across the region. And the problem is that people are fed up of dictatorships or military regimes or monarchies and want civilian rule. But at the same time, the danger comes in when civilian rule comes in. At what cost? Does it come in as, you know, you now taken a group of corrupt people out and you put in a civilian rule in, right? And there's no guarantee that civilian rule is going to not go follow the route of its predecessor and, you know, be embroiled in corruption and fraud, etc. And the thing is that what we've seen is that frustrations are coming about whereby people lose faith, right? You've seen a sudden rise of atheism amongst the youth in these countries. It's prevalent in Egypt. It's, you know, although Sudan is more, very strong Islamically, but it can happen there. It's happening in other countries in the Middle East. And this is just one danger. Then you have other dangers as well, that, you know, where you find that, you know, your Muslim society per se tends to, you know, drift away from the teachings of Islam, because sometimes people, you know, in their frustration, in their anger, in their sorrow, tend to, you know, conflate the two together that corruption is a result of, you know, of so-called, you know, wrong following of Dini teachings. But at the end of the day, our Dini teachings have taught us that, you know, fraud, I mean, there's a whole surah in the Quran dedicated to fraud. So, you know, at the end of the day, this is what we need to look at. Now, another country that's been having also problems, as I said, has been Iraq and Lebanon. And just to, you know, this has just come in this morning, so just to, you know, read to you about what's happening there, that there has been, that the Iraqi protesters are hopeful again, as they have hailed Ayatollah Sistani's speech. Now, Ayatollah Sistani berated security forces for failing to protect protesters killed in clashes with Sadrs in Najaf. Now, what happened was that Iraqi activists and anti-government protesters, right, have welcomed the speech of top Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, in which he has condemned the security forces for failing to protect the protesters killed in clashes in the southern city of Najaf this week. Iraq's anti-government protesters were looking for support from the country's top religious leader after followers of popular Shia leader Muqtada al-Sadr turned on protest sit-ins in the capital Baghdad and the southern holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. Iraq's protest movement began in October to decry corruption, unemployment and the lack of basic services. At least 500 people have been killed and thousands of others injured in the months-long unrest. But recent days have seen a new turn in events after al-Sadr's Saray al-Salam militia, known as the Blue Hats, because of the headgear they often wear, attacked anti-government protesters who rejected the nomination last week of Muhammad Alawi as the new prime minister designate. A representative of al-Sistani, who delivered the speech from Karbala on Friday, condemned the deadly violence that killed several protesters on Wednesday night in Najaf and injured more than 100 others after Sadr supporters clashed with protesters in Sadrain Square. On Thursday, the 6th of February, witnesses said 10 people were also wounded in the central city of Karbala in clashes between anti-government protesters and al-Sadr supporters. In his speech, al-Sistani called on security forces to protect anti-government demonstrators from any further attacks. It is the security forces that must take responsibility to keep the peace, protect the protest squares and the peaceful demonstrators, and identify attackers and rabble-rousers, he said. There is no excuse for shirking that duty. He also called for early elections and urged the politicians to select a government acceptable to the public. This has obviously created a positive feeling. In Tahrir Square, the hub of the protest movement in Baghdad, protesters told Al Jazeera they were happy with al-Sistani's speech. We are feeling positive in Tahrir Square after al-Sistani condemned what happened in Najaf and berated the security forces for not protecting us, said Mohammed Abbas, a 20-year-old student from Baghdad. Al-Sistani, who enjoys influence over Iraq's Shia majority, rarely comments on politics, but he is seen by the protesters as the final vestige of support within the establishment. Unlike Muqtada al-Sadr and many of the political leaders in Iraq, Sistani has been consistent in his message and stance to support our demands for elections and a representative leader throughout, said Mohammed Abbas. Al-Sadr had initially backed the protest movement, which began in early October in the capital of Baghdad and Iraq's mostly Shia south, but he has since changed his position several times, withdrawing his support before Alawi's appointment, which prompted some of his supporters to leave the protest camps. He then called on his followers to return to the streets, only to later shift his stance again and urge them to come together to reveal the saboteurs and the nationalist pretenders by helping the security forces. Observers have pinned the withdrawal of al-Sadr's support for the protest movement as part of his agreement with the country's largest parliamentary blocs, most of which are backed by Iran, to nominate Alawi for the prime minister's position. Ali Ali Ghraibit, a 27-year-old filmmaker and protester in Baghdad, said he expected nothing less from al-Sistani's speech. After Sistani holding the security forces accountable, we are hopeful again, Ghraibit told Al Jazeera, adding that he expected the number of protesters in Tahrir Square, which had dwindled over the past week, to increase again. He says, I hope the protest movement will now go back to being strong like it was before, said Ghraibit. However, other protesters said they were slightly disappointed and had hoped for more from al-Sistani's speech. Al-Sistani's condemnation of the security forces was good, but he did not mention Alawi or say that he rejects him, said Maryam Ali, a 27-year-old nurse in Tahrir Square. Alawi's appointment last week was the reason behind the recent escalation, she said. So, you've seen that this is what's happening in Iraq, and you know, this obviously leads a bit of credence to the assassination of former Iranian General Qasim al-Soleimani, that, you know, that he was involved in Iraq's internal politics, right? I'm not going to go into the details of his death and to the, all the conspiracy theories, etc., but we're just looking at what I've told you now about the parliamentary block in Iraq that's backed up by Iran. This leads credibility to the fact that he was instrumental in the interference in internal politics, and of course, you know, with the uprising that began in October last year, there has been a lot of setbacks, right? Obviously we have to see what will happen next. I mean, this, you know, as much as people criticize Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for interfering in Middle Eastern governments and in Middle Eastern countries, we see equally that Iran has also must shoulder the responsibility for interfering in countries as well. And in fact, both are to blame. When I say both, we take Saudi Arabia and the UAE together with Egypt, of course, on the one side, right? And you have Iran on the other side. And together, both are causing trouble in the Middle East. For what reason? Allah knows best. Okay, at the end of the day, it is the powers that are behind in their benefit, right? You've got the Yanks, the British, the French, and the Israelis, and other parts of the EU behind the Saudis, the UAE, and Egypt, and you've got Russia and you know, China, and that behind Iran. So at the end of the day, really speaking, should this continue? Can't these countries allow other countries to have the right to self-determination? Iraq, let the Iraqi people, fine, I mean, we know that Iraq has got a large Shia majority, but that does not give Iran the right to interfere in its internal policies. Likewise, in a country that's got a Sunni majority, doesn't give Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to interfere there as well. We've seen enough examples of what's been happening, and where bloodshed has been the order of the day. It's in Syria, it's in Yemen, and Iraq has been obviously volatile since the Bush and Blair illegal invasion by Bush and Blair in 2003, and this is going to cause a wider effect if this does not stop, right? Coming to a bit of the local side, well, you know, speaking about Brother A.B. Dowji, he did say, of course, earlier that, you know, I did tell you about his dad not being well, but, you know, he couldn't make it to today's show because he sent a sick note to me, dated the 23rd of July, signed by Dr. Doolittle, the veterinarian. Now, coming to that, everybody says that the sick note is on everybody's lips at the moment. That was presented in court this week by Jacob Zuma's lawyers in Pietermaritzburg, and the judge that was sitting in, Judge Daya Pillay, rejected the sick note, said that it's very vague, it does not explain what's his condition, and issued a warrant of arrest for the former president. Obviously, the warrant of arrest has been stayed till his next court appearance, which is due for early May. So, Brother A.B. Dowji produced to me a sick note from Dr. Doolittle. So he says, and it's backdated to 23rd of July, although today is the 8th of February. So, just a bit of lighthearted humor. And talking about the sick note, well, social media was abuzz, making criticism of the sick note, and within the next day or two, there Jacob Zuma put his foot in it, whereby he posted a picture of himself on Twitter sitting on a chair leaning against a quad bike with a rifle in his hand shooting at something. So you know, obviously the social media trolls went on the prowl and found that he's apparently sitting somewhere at some lodge or some game park somewhere, having a moment to himself, and you know, brings up the question: is he sick, or is he as sick as he claims to be that he couldn't make it to court? And this is what we're seeing at the moment happening in South Africa, our beautiful country. That's lots of load shedding. There's, more and more revelations at the Zondo Commission. And SAA, of course, SAA, our national carrier, soon will have no wings. Already, they made a very, surprising announcement on Thursday night that they're cancelling all domestic routes except Johannesburg, Cape Town. Now, you have a national carrier that can't fly internally between its cities. There's a problem, right? That's a big problem. Okay, the reason why people don't fly SAA is because SAA's flights are too expensive. A flight from Durban to Bloemfontein return costs 5,000 rand. Okay, it's on one of SAA's smaller planes, SAA Link or SAA Express. But the fact remains, this is why we're having a problem with our national carrier. And then you have our low-cost carriers that are giving it a go for the money. I mean, Mango belongs to SAA. If Mango can charge those sort of competitive rates, why can't SAA do it? Cut out the frills, cut out the food, etc., and have, if you want to keep the national carrier operational, cut out all the frills. People will use the airline gratis because no domestic flight in South Africa is longer than 2 hours at any given point. Durban to Cape Town is 2 hours. Joburg to Cape Town is under 2 hours. So no, there's no direct flight from, say, Polokwane to Cape Town, which will be obviously longer, but there's no direct flight in any domestic flight that's longer than two hours. And if people are on a plane and there's no frills such as, in food service, etc., then obviously these, it can be viable for the airline to carry on. And also, they cut out a lot of international destinations. I mean, one of the most popular SAA routes have been Johannesburg to Hong Kong. But in the past few years, you have seen that diminishing because of the Gulf Airlines, which, provide far better service, better aircraft, etc. And you have the Far Eastern carriers of Singapore Airlines, Cathay Pacific, etc., that provide that service. But a direct route from Johannesburg to Hong Kong, which has been in operation for decades, suddenly stops. Okay, Johannesburg, Guangzhou, well, okay, that was experimental routes like how they had Johannesburg, Beijing, etc. And another route that has been stopped has been Johannesburg-Sao Paulo. Johannesburg-Sao Paulo, it surprises me because at the end of the day, it is the only airline from Southern Africa that flies to Latin America. And you're having a lot of travel between Latin America and Southern Africa, especially South Africa. Now, if people want to go to Brazil or any part of Latin, they must fly maybe to Dubai and catch a flight from there to Sao Paulo. Does it make sense? No, it doesn't make sense, right? So, at the end of the day, what is happening really at SAA and the mess at SAA, it's all coming out to light. The unions obviously are being unreasonable and are blaming the business rescue practitioners. The business rescue practitioners are saying, listen, we're implementing what needs to be implemented, right? Surely they'll see that, once they disregard certain of these routes, that there is a problem here and maybe they made a mistake and will probably reverse it. But look at the practicality. Today, where air travel is not a luxury, it's a necessity, to cut out such routes, it doesn't make sense. Anyway, that's all what we have time for today. Unfortunately, we couldn't get our guests on the line, Brother Aslam Mayat and Dr. Faisal Suleiman. But nevertheless, you heard from Brother Nazir the announcement for the action against CAA for next Sunday, the 16th of February. We'll cover it again on next week's show, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.